honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the state of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is Thomas versus Peterson. Before we get to the case, however, court will introduce itself. I'm Mike Hattigan, the Chief Justice, and by seniority on the court, we go to our WebEx participant. As you can see, we've got six members of the court here, and on WebEx, we have
Judge Miller Lerman here, participating by WebEx. Good morning. Thank you.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy.
Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Tappick.
John Freidenberg.
And again, good morning to all of you. Thank you for abiding by our coronavirus rules or suggestions. Please keep your masks on, if at all possible, when you are not presenting. When you are presenting, please take your masks off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. And as you can already tell, Justice Miller Lerman, she may be on WebEx, but she is perfectly capable of participating just like all of the other judges here in the courtroom. Does anybody have any questions before we begin? I'm hearing no questions. Mr. Mossman, you may approach and you may proceed, and good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Justices, and may it please the court and counsel, this is the last of the initiative cases that you're going to hear this week. And I promise you, you weren't going to hear the word single subject out of my mouth. So start with that. So Steve Mossman representing the appellant Trina Thomas in this matter. You have a bit of a unique opportunity, despite the statutory scheming in place for some time. This is the first case that has been before an appellate court. So we can stop, as parties can stop citing to orders of the Lancaster County District Court in all of our dealings on the ballot title. I would reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to start with clearing up some of the issues regarding the evidence in this case before getting to what we believe should be the standard of review and then our argument. On the evidence, the attorney generals and the sponsors, we believe, misconstrue our position, which could have been maybe a little bit clearer. Our position is that the district court and this court should have considered the initiative measure, the act that it seeks to amend, and to the extent that the act is ambiguous, official Department of Banking and Finance interpretations of the act, in other words, the applicable law. The sponsors offered Exhibits 1 and 2, which was department consent orders interpreting and issued pursuant to the act, the department issued delayed deposit services business license act, pursuant to the act, and an interpretive opinion that was issued by the DDS pursuant to the act, and then a form that was used for delayed deferred deposit agreements and truth in lendings. That was exhibits numbers 1 and 2. The state offered exhibit number 3, which is the initiative measure, which is obviously proper. And then exhibit number 4 is the department report, annual report. And that's from the Department of Banking and Finance. It's not issued as we see it pursuant to the act. And it's by a statute that requires the department to collect, collate, assort, systemize, and report statistical details. That was actually offered twice at the hearing in district court. I believe it was objected to once, but perhaps not the other time. But we don't think that that should have been considered by the district court. And then we get to the part that we believe is problematic in terms of the evidence received by the district court, and that is printouts from websites, described in the briefs in this case as marketing materials. And we do not believe the district court should have considered that evidence.
What objection was made at the hearing on Exhibit 5?
On Exhibit 5, the objection was to the paragraphs 5 through 11 and the
specific objections?
The objections were foundation, hearsay, and relevance. And the key, I think, would be the relevance. And again, I don't, you know, I'm not sure we're to the point where somebody sitting in an office printing things off website provides sufficient foundation to it. So that was Exhibit 3, the state's exhibit, and paragraphs 5 through 11, and the attachments that went with that. The sponsors had Exhibit number 5. Attachment A was the 2019 department report that I've discussed. That was attachment B. Attachment A was a statistical report that is done by the pursuant to the Delayed Deposit Act. And there was no objection to that. And there was an objection to the department report. And then we get to attachments C and J, C through J of exhibit number 5. And again, those are websites that were printed off. There was a newspaper article, which, you know, it is not evidence as far as we were concerned. And then there was a transcript to a legislative hearing that I don't think there was any foundation supplied for that. So there were objections to all of what we consider this extrinsic evidence. And the distinction between the evidence that Thomas offered was that it was not extrinsic to the act, the initiative measure that seeks to amend the act, and the applicable law. And that the evidence that was objected to received over objection by the state and the sponsors. Again, a lot of it consisted of somebody sitting in an office printing off websites. With respect to what evidence should be considered, I would cite the court to a Missouri case. Missouri has the same very similar statutory scheme. And State Actual Candor versus Green, Missouri 462 Southwest 3844. Missouri Court of Appeals says that the language of the ballot summary is the relevant consideration, and we believe that evidence would be appropriate rarely, if ever, to address a challenge to a ballot summary. And we think that that should be the appropriate law that this court adopts, again, pursuant to the first time you've ever considered the ballot title statute. I'd like to get on to the standard of review, and the district court, we believe, erred in applying a differential standard under NebRevStat 3214.10 sub 3. That statute requires only that the person requesting a different ballot title set forth why the attorney general's title is, quote, insufficient or unfair. The district court's ruling, again, relying on previous rulings from other district court judge, Lancaster County district court judges, and no offense to Justice Stacey, but they added the word clearly before insufficient or unfair. That term, clearly, is nowhere found in the statute. This court has held as recently as this year that statutory language is to be given its plain and ordinary meaning, and an appellate court will not resort to interpretation to ascertain the meaning of statutory words which are plain, direct, and unambiguous, and it is not within the province of the courts to read a meaning into a statute that is not there.
Even if clearly is taken out, say that the review is just, is it sufficient and is it fair? Is it still a deferential standard? Is the Attorney General's office still get some deference in the words that they use?
Based upon statutory language, we do not believe that it should have a deferential standard, Justice. We obviously Thomas in this case is the complainant has the burden of persuasion and proof, but we don't believe that there should be any deference given to the ballot title prepared by the Attorney General. And we think that is based upon the specific language of 3214.10 sub 3.
But it does say it's sufficient. Doesn't have to be perfect. We're not going to wordsmith it, right? There's some leeway the Attorney General would have. Is that fair?
I don't think the name is asking the court to wordsmith it. But in terms of the insufficient or unfair, we do not believe that the burden should be clearly placed on that. And again,
so what do you think is the difference between clearly insufficient or unfair or just insufficient or unfair?
Well, to me, the word clearly, this court uses the word clearly in a higher burden of proof than preponderance. And we don't think that that higher burden of proof should or persuasion should apply here. So we do think that clearly is something more than preponderance. It is a higher standard of review. And again, I think injunction cases, for instance, use that term before determining whether injunction should lie. I was going to get to the language of the statute 3214.10 sub 3, and it says, it directs the district court to, quote, examine the measure, the arguments, and in its decision, certify to the Nebraska Secretary of State a ballot title for the measure in accord with the intent of the section. And we don't believe that that statute expressly or impliedly adds any deference to the Attorney General.
Doesn't the first part of subsection 3 sort of begin with a implicit presumption that the Attorney General's product is sufficient and fair and impose upon the person challenging it some obligation to show that it's insufficient or unfair?
And I think that's the typical burden of proof, Justice Castle. So I would not dispute that.
Okay, thank you.
So we looked in prior to the recodification of the election code by LB76 in 1994, this statute in it, pretty much its identical form was there as NBRA Stat 32707, and it appeared to have the same, pretty much the exact language. So we don't think anything's changed in the statute. So we don't believe that the Attorney General's ballot title should have been given any deference, but it is the burden of proof for the plaintiff in this case.
What's our standard of review in this case?
Your standard of review would be de novo on the law. Yeah, it'd be a de novo standard of review.
Counsel, once a case like this gets to the district court, does section 3214.10 sub 3 appear to contemplate the receipt of additional evidence?
I don't believe that. Again, I quoted the language, examine the measure, hear arguments, and its decision, certify the Secretary of State. That's the language that that we believe is controlling here. And I'll take a look at that and address it on rebuttal to get back to you on that.
Is offering the interpretive opinion by the challengers offering of evidence that's beyond just the measure?
Well, and again, we believe that that evidence
scope, yeah, understanding.
That's a good question. We believe that even that should only be considered if the act is considered, the act or the measure that is to amend the act is considered ambiguous. And I was actually just getting to that. The Delayed Deposit Services Licensing Act expressly and unambiguously defines what a delayed deposit service business is. That's in NBRA Stat 45902 sub 4. And what you won't find in any of the definitions in NBRA Stat 45902 is any definition that says the term payday lenders in it. That term appears once in the act, and that's way at the end where there's a laundry list of what needs to be reported to other states. So not dealing with the with its interpretation in Nebraska. The initiative measure does not contain the term payday lenders in it. And if the sponsors felt that strongly that term should be used in the ballot title, for instance, then they certainly could have used that term in the initiative measure, which they did not.
I beg your pardon. You don't take the position that the title, or do you take the position that what emerges in the title is restricted to the language of the proposal? Can it differ?
Our position would be that if it's unambiguous, the language in the act that seeks to be amended and the language in the initiative measure should control what's in the ballot title. And based upon the evidence presented by the Attorney General's in this case, office in this case, they had a bunch of printouts of websites. And what I don't think is, I think the Attorney General's job is to look at the act, look at the initiative seeking to amend the act, and determine the ballot title based upon that. I don't think it's appropriate to look at these extrinsic materials like websites and marketing materials.
Can the Attorney General look at any extrinsic evidence or materials?
Our position would be that they should not.
Suppose you had an initiative that dealt with the practice of podiatry. Would a ballot title that referred to this as a foot doctor, even though that term appeared nowhere in the initiative, be a legitimate phrase in a ballot title?
I would think that they would have to be limited to the actual technical name of the profession that they're seeking to.
Is there a difference in my hypothetical? Is there any difference between podiatry and foot doctor?
I think if it's dealing with changes to the licensing of a podiatrist, that should be language in the ballot title.
Can the Attorney General look at a dictionary or thesaurus?
Well, there was, you know, we don't have any evidence, obviously, of what the Attorney General did. The only thing we can glean is what the Attorney General's office presented in exhibit number 4 at the hearing in this case. And again, there's no record of what the Attorney General does or does not review in coming up with the ballot title. But
maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you said that the Attorney General couldn't look at anything extrinsic whatsoever.
Well, that would be our position. And we don't have any evidence of what they looked at other than what they offered it.
So I take it your answer is the Attorney General could not look at the dictionary in coming up with the proper language.
The Attorney General should look at, correct, Your Honor, the Attorney General should look at the Act and the amendment that the initiative measure seeks to amend the Act.
Would it be proper for the Attorney General to look at other words that may or may not be synonyms, not in the very words of the proposal, but elsewhere in statutes or regulations by way of, say, just taking notice of those? Or is your proposal, if the words are not, I'm sorry, if your argument is that the words are not in the proposal, they cannot be used in a title. I'm trying to figure out how narrow your position is. Thanks.
The position is pretty, in this case at least, it's pretty narrow, that the initiative measure and the Act define what the voters are going to be amending in Nebraska statute, and those should be the terms that the ballot title uses, at least in this case. I guess in terms of, this is the first time that this court is going to hear a ballot title challenge, and it's appropriate to lay down some rules, but I don't know about a blanket prohibition about anything. But I guess in this case, we believe that the definitions in the Act are clear, the initiative measure is clear, and that the ballot title should be based upon those two.
Thank you.
What's your position on the issue of jurisdiction, explanatory statement, and the ballot title?
That's a very good question, Justice Monk. If you look at the language of 3214.10 sub 3, it would be our position that the ballot title and the statute uses the term statement preceding the ballot title. It didn't technically use the term explanatory statement. I think that's the shorthand that's been used. And that is sandwiched in between two different statutes that talk about the ballot title. Our position would be that the ballot title and the statement explaining the measure are so inextricably tied that term is, the ballot title collectively encompasses both of those.
Can you have one without the other?
You cannot have one without the other in the statute, and that it would be a little bit of an absurd result for the court system to have the ability to change the ballot title but not the explanatory statement, since they're tied together and they both print a ballot.
Well, in this situation, payday lenders use it both.
It's used in both.
So if we were to find that payday lender term was insufficient or unfair in the ballot title, but it was slapped in the explanatory statement, does that make any sense?
It doesn't make any sense to us, Your Honor. And we did plead that in the complaint that was filed and set forth a different explanatory title as the statute requires for the plaintiff to do in those cases. I'm going to save the rest of time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Post, good morning to you.
Good morning. And the appellees will be splitting time 10 minutes each, approximately.
Thank you. The clock does not break that out, correct?
The clock will not break out.
You have to watch.
Got it. I've been watching. May it please the court. A ballot title is supposed to express the purpose of the major in 100 words or less. That's what's required of the Attorney General. There's no allegation that that did not happen here. Instead, the focus is on the use of the term payday lender, term the industry itself uses. Yes, the district court applied a deferential standard of review based on the statute and based on decades of precedent, both in the District Court of Lancaster County, as well as nationwide. The majority of courts nationwide, and this is explained in a brief, but the reason they apply a deferential standard of review, even if it's not contained in the specific text of the statute, because it's not in most states nationwide, is because courts don't want to sit and wordsmith or sit as a literary editorial board of every single ballot title every cycle. Again, we would submit it's not the role of the court to draft every one of these ballot titles. It's actually the duty of the Attorney General by statute.
What is your view, if I may, with respect to the Missouri case to which opposing counsel refers? Did they get something right or wrong, or should we import their reasoning? Thank you.
So I understand the focus on the Missouri case, but I'm gonna pick out both Missouri and Arkansas for a reason. So if you look at Missouri and Arkansas, what you're going to see is more ballot title challenges than you see in any other jurisdiction. And in those cases, they're applying, for lack of a better description, a common law that has formed under those challenges. When we look at the other states around the country, we're looking at specific reference to the text of the statute, as well as the precedent that that's court applied for all of the reasons that I was discussing. Yes, I agree. Missouri uses, I believe they use the insufficient and unfair language. But at a certain point, this is the first opportunity for this court to decide what the standard is going to be. And we would submit that this court should follow what the majority of other courts have done.
I beg your pardon. The language that we are trying to assess and informs the scope of what this court does is found in a statute rather than a constitutional provision, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
And so applying that statute here, and we made the legislative acquiescence argument as well, at a certain point after 35 years of using this test, we haven't heard anything today that would provide a reason to upend the test that, again, is used by the District Court of Lancaster County and majority of courts nationwide. So I'm going to let Mr. Laughlin address specifically the sufficiency and fairness, but again, it's the position of the Attorney General and the Secretary of State that this particular ballot title is both sufficient and fair.
What can the Attorney General review in determining what is a appropriate ballot title, explanatory statement?
Arguably under the statute, anything we want. I think there's going to be big bounds on that. I can tell you practically what happens. The Attorney General looks at the ballot title. We want to make sure we can express the purpose based on what the purpose of the proposed major says to the voters in 100 words or less. And I know that sounds like I'm just quoting the statute back to you, but that's actually kind of hard to do. Some of these initiatives contain, regardless of single subject issues, contain a lot of provisions. And at a certain point, we have to be able to have a little bit of discretion to come up with what we think is the most fair description of what the initiative is going to do. And so I want to give you an example. I appreciated the hypothetical earlier, but this would be a more recent example of why sticking to the text of a major could be problematic, and I think why the statute doesn't say this. Admittedly, when you go to draft a statute or initiative, you can get rather creative. So here's an example where if the Attorney General was stuck to the text, the voters would not understand the purpose. Shall Nebraska change the penalty for Class 1 felonies? If a proposal was going to amend out the death penalty, that would be an accurate statement of the law and a statement of the text of the statute, but the voters would have no idea what the purpose of that particular initiative is. And so, again, that's why we don't think the Attorney General should be stuck to the specific text of the statute. Briefly, I want to touch on the explanatory statement. Again, the reason, I think part of the reason it's been framed as a jurisdictional argument below is ultimately, at the end of the day, this is a suit against the state. And so the statute only provides for a particular type of suit against the state, and that suit is on the ballot title. There's no provision about how the court would review an explanatory statement.
So what happens if the ballot title use of payday lender is found to be unfair and insufficient? What happens to the explanatory statement?
Stay the same.
Stays the same.
And I would submit that's for the legislature to fix if they want to change.
So what's the exercise here?
It would solely be to review the ballot title. And if the words payday lending were taken out, then the explanatory statement would remain. And I think one thing to hit on there, the explanatory statement can be longer. So it's been the practice of the Attorney General's office. You've probably seen this. The ballot title and the explanatory statement often mirror each other, but there's no requirement that they do that. They are two very different things, and they technically, under the statute, they have a different purpose. In a lot of other states, when you look at the other case law, it's just one thing. There's not two separate things. They'll roll the title and the statement together in the analysis or in the way it's written. So here, these are supposed to be two separate things. So it's at least possible that the Attorney General could draft an explanatory statement with significantly different language than the ballot title, because as my brief explained, they're supposed to serve two different purposes. Now, we've taken the position that we're going to pretty much say the same thing in both, but I don't believe the statute actually requires them to mirror each other. And so if we were in a scenario where they were both grouped together, I'm having trouble understanding how a court would take a couple words out of the ballot title and maybe take a couple different words out of the explanatory statement for different reasons, or how that process would shake out. And again, I would submit it'd be most appropriate for the legislature to spell that process out if that's actually what they intended.
Is there any validity to the idea that using a catchphrase or a common phrase in lieu of all the words in the proposal becomes not just practical but necessary given the word limit? So if you took all the words from the proposal, you hardly have space left to reach 100. Thank you.
Yes, and that is common, actually. So again, I'm referencing other ballot titles that might exist with many provisions. Sometimes the Attorney General in the ballot title for those initiatives might say subject to regulation, because we cannot fit all of the proposed regulations or exemptions within 100 words. And so there is just a practical necessity, if you're going to be stuck to 100 words, that you may not be able to use the exact text. You might have to use a word I don't want to say understand, because our job is not to educate the voters, but our job is to explain the purpose. And so we're going to have to use the best words we can to explain the purpose within 100 words.
What's our standard of review?
So again, because this court hasn't addressed it, I think we're going to go with the classic de novo on the law, as well as the deference that we're asking for the Attorney General. But there's not there's no case to reference that. I don't imagine this court's going to defer to the district court. So
what level of deference to the Attorney General are you suggesting?
So we are suggesting that the standard is clearly unfair and insufficient. And I understand the text of the statute does not say that. But again, the case law, both in the district court and nationwide, that is the test. And it's sound repetitive, but it's for the reasons that I mentioned previously.
And presumably the legislature was aware of the law from around the country and they chose not to use the word clearly.
Well, so as Mr. Mossman mentioned, this Nebraska text was pretty common nationwide. It's only a recent development that these things have started to be tinkered with in other states. And again, that's in the brief. And so it is entirely possible that they were aware of the case from California from the 1930s. I don't know, but I could speculate in that regard. If you really go back in time and look at the case law, most of the case law from other jurisdictions is talking about insufficient and unfair. Again, that changes over time for various reasons, but it seems to have been part of a consistent act that's passed around the country.
When we write our opinions, the custom is not to cite external sites like the web, partly because of link rot, and maybe there's a good idea not to put our trust in things that have not been vetted as an evidentiary matter. How does that impact our analysis? Because at some point here, no doubt, we dispose of this case in an opinion.
So in this case, and I understand that concern, in this case, I think it's a little easier because we have a factual finding of the district court. And so this court's just going to cite to that factual finding. As it relates to the link route or the fact that both appellees used websites, first of all, the copies of those websites were submitted into evidence. And I would point out there's actually no assignment of error related to any specific objections to the evidence. The only assignment of error on evidence is the receipt of evidence at all. And it's our position that the district court could receive evidence in this type of case. There's no prohibition on it. If there's no more questions, I'd like to leave your
thank you.
For Mr. Laughlin. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Laughlin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
The reason that the Attorney General is doing this is so that the average voter, when they read the initiative, when they read what they're voting on, understands it. And they have a very tough job. The legislature's put a very tough job on them in that regard, Mr. Post and his team. They have to summarize the initiative in less, in 100 words or less, which is Justice Miller-Lehrman referenced, is a very hard task, and be clear and concise. That is a very different and much harder charge than turning in a brief to the Supreme Court, where we have a lot more pages, where we have a common history.
It's going to be concise. It may not be clear.
I understand that. But the point is that this isn't a situation where we turn in a brief to the court, where we cite statutes, where we do statutory construction, where we all have a common language and understanding, where the court has weeks to go back and consider it. And that's part of the reason why this reference to statutes that they rely on doesn't work. This is a process to make it clear and concise, and that's the job of the Attorney General. And so, for example, Your Honor, the fact that the evidence showed that nobody really knew what a delayed deposit service provider was. And everybody knows, the general public knows, what a payday lender is. So, for example, if you all go in, let's say you're reading your ballot and it says something like, this initiative is supposed to limit the amount that the state can charge if you want to go and ask for a placa. Now, how would you vote? But if they added the language, if the Attorney General added the language that this initiative is to limit to $50 what the state can charge for a placa, otherwise known as a license plate, then I would propose you would significantly understand the purpose of why you're voting, be able to understand what it is. It's much more clear and it's much more concise. And that's another reason why the appellant's argument that we're somehow limited to only, this first time I've heard today, only statutory construction, not only does it not work, but to the extent the argument is that it is in some way limits the Attorney General from stating the purpose, that it somehow limits the Attorney General from being clear, then it's in direct violation of the statute, their argument. I would also point out, Your Honors, that they cite not a single case to support this novel proposition that we're somehow, no extrinsic evidence can be considered, and they can only talk in statutory language like lawyers do in trying to help the voter understand. They don't cite a single case in any jurisdiction, on any ballot issue, anywhere, anytime. And so as far as their brief says, this is the first time in the history of American jurisprudence that this argument is being put forward. And also, Your Honor, the boundaries, the vagueness of what they're looking for. Some of your questions went to the vagueness of what the Attorney General can consider. I would throw out when you really think about it, what are they really saying? Is there a word? What if a word isn't in the statute? How about and? How about reduce? How about the? How about the dictionary definitions as we're asked? When you really think about it, they haven't even really defined the boundaries of the very proposition that they're saying. So it's novel and vague, and to the extent that it does in this case prohibit the Attorney General from stating the purpose and prohibit the Attorney General from being clear, we would contend that it is in direct violation of Nebraska law. The evidence, and I think Mr. Mossman misspoke, they actually offered at trial affirmative evidence. They offered the delayed deposit services contract that their client put in. They offered the interpretive opinion of the Department of Banking that they now claim the court shouldn't look at. And so our argument, Justice Funk, getting back to one of your questions, is that that argument has been waived. They offered evidence. They argued to the court that the court should rule in their favor based on their evidence. And then dissatisfied with the result, they now take 180 degrees and most importantly, they're asserting a basis of objection here that's different from what they asserted in the district court. They did object on hearsay, but they're not asserting that objection here. What they didn't do is stand up and object and say, hey, you can't consider any evidence. They didn't do that because they wanted their evidence in and they got their evidence in. They wanted their evidence considered by the court and they got their evidence considered by the court. And now they're dissatisfied with the result, so they're trying to change. I would also, another point I wanted to make was the definition of unfair and insufficient. The appellant cite a case from Missouri that says that means marked by injustice or deception. And the sponsors, would embrace that definition and say, how can it be that a statement that the evidence confirms is factually true, that being that payday lenders are the delayed deposit service licensees are also known as payday lenders. In fact, in reality, based on the evidence in the record that frankly is undisputed, I don't think Mr. Mossman, when he gets back up here, is going to tell you that his client is not a payday lender. There's no evidence in the record that there is a delayed deposit service provider who is not also a payday lender and vice versa. The evidence is undisputed in the record that those two terms are factually identical. And so to say that the Attorney General has given something as true, has given a small phrase, otherwise known, also known as payday lenders, it's factually correct. It's that the payday lending industry, that's the marketing term that they use themselves to bring in people, to get more business and make more profits. And the very word that they use to increase profits, and their profits are $28 million a year at an average interest rate of over 380%, which is why 124,000 Nebraskans have signed a petition saying we want Nebraskans to weigh in on what the law should be. When they come in and they say, that's the word they use to get business, but that's the same word that they're here today to tell you, but we don't want the voters to know that's who we are when they're determining what interest rate we can charge.
To what extent do you take the position that within the title there exists the phrase also known as? So that, is this your argument, the voters are being advised, this is colloquial or arguably a synonym for the more lengthy or more technical expression, does the also known as help our analysis?
Justice Miller-Lehrman, I'm not sure that I understand the point of your question, but I would answer this way. It clearly better expresses the purpose for voters who don't know what a delayed deposit service licensee is and absolutely know what a payday lender is. So, yes, it does. Was that your question or did I miss it?
My question wasn't very well phrased. Let me try again. Also known as, is that a signal to the voters that for purposes of economy or possibly clarity, we're going to use another phrase and still meet our 100-word limit. The voters are therefore informed that payday is not, payday lenders is not a word of art, nor does the title claim it to be.
With 18 seconds left, I think the answer to your question is yes. That is what we're arguing. That is exactly what we're arguing.
Thank you.
Are the parties in this case, or any of the parties, your opponents, taking the position that payday lender is a pejorative phrase?
And by pejorative, you mean?
Attempting to depict it in an unfavorable way.
I think Mr. Mossman can answer for himself. I think his answer is yes, because he uses the term slang. To which my only response, Your Honor, is this is the way that they self-identify themselves to the public, to the marketing. It's how their industry identifies itself. It's how they're in, it's how they're depicted. It's how they're named in the press. It's how people know them.
So your client's perspective is it's not a pejorative.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We have time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes and 53 seconds.
2 minutes and 53 seconds, Mr. Mossman.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Again, I'd start with the general proposition that if the sponsors felt so strongly that this language should be in the ballot title, they could have included it in the initiative measure when they were drafting that. They could have added it.
Are your clients not proud of the name payday lender?
Well, what I would say, Judge, is that the I point to the Arkansas case. Arkansas has similar language in the Constitution. And they've developed a body of case law. There's a case, Parker versus Priest, and it's cited in our brief, but they say that the ballot title should be free from any misleading tendency, whether of application or omission. And here, when we've defined it by the terms of the act and the terms of the initiative measure, amplifying it by adding an additional name would be amplification. We don't think that would be proper here. I have not.
Some phrases may carry some baggage with them, but isn't the test whether that baggage is fair or unfair?
Well, and again, based on the Arkansas cases, whether it's an amplification, but that is the test under the statute, right? Insufficient or unfair.
Do you believe payday lender is a pejorative term?
I believe that there are a lot of terms that could be used to describe an industry, but the term that the legislature has used to describe it is in the statute and in the initiative measure that's there.
You would agree that's not the phrase you hear from the average person on the street.
I haven't asked the average person on the street, Justice Castle, but I've certainly driven by and seen advertisements that say different things. I've seen paycheck advance. I've seen other things that aren't in the ballot title. And I'm certainly not a student on the industry, but that would be our position.
I beg your pardon. If the title were to expand on also known as, and say something further, like also known as, but not the technical term used by a bunch of lawyers like us, would that inform the voters in a better way that this is a shorthand for the economy of meeting 100 words? Thank you.
It may. I don't know that they could meet 100 words. I didn't count the words. So I don't think it meet 100 words if they added that amplification, Justice. But it may add to it a little bit. I would get back to Justice Stacey's question. I did go back and review the entire text of 3214.10.3, and I did not see any indication in that entire language that evidence should be used. And there is a case, specifically the Missouri case, that says evidence should not be considered. So this is not a novel argument that's being made or, you know, even been applied by an appellate court in this
Couldn't there be a case where the party in your position would need to rely on evidence to show that something is misleading or unfair, show that there's some, for example, some pejorative connotation of payday lender out there?
We just believe that the statute and the initiative measure are clear in this case. There could be a case out there, but we don't think that this is that case, Justice. My lights are all flashing, so I'm out of time. Again, appreciate you expediting this matter to be heard, so we finally have an opinion on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are excused. We'll go on to the next case of the day. Now, the process you should use while leaving the courtroom is that we hope you keep your masks on and distance as much as possible, that you leave by this side door here. And then after you leave, we go on to the next case, that a cleaning crew comes in and cleans everything up between cases. So thank you very much.